On Thursday, the 15th of May, The Spectator is hosting a live book club event. Sam Leith will be joined by former Telegraph editor-in-chief and military historian Max Hastings. It will be an opportunity to talk about Max's new book, Sword, D-Day, Trial by Battle, as well as mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day. The full details are as follows. 7:30 on Thursday the 15th of May at the Shaw Theatre in Euston, London, and tickets start from £27.50, although I believe there are ticket options that include a signed copy of the book. For those tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/bookslive. We look forward to seeing you there.
Good evening, and welcome to Coffee House Shots Live, the local elections shake-up. I'm absolutely delighted that we have Zia Youssef, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Lucy Dunn, and James Heal with me in order to dissect what are probably the most significant local election results that we've seen for years. I'm also delighted that all of you are here as well, because after we've had our discussion on stage, I want to invite questions from the audience so that you have an opportunity to dig even deeper into our panel's reflections on what happened last week and what its consequences are for our politics. I also want to thank our partners who sponsored this evening, Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. And in particular, I'd like to thank Charles Stanley, not just for their sponsorship of this event, but their continued sponsorship of so many Spectator events that bring political debate direct to you, our readers and subscribers. I'm going to begin by asking James, as Deputy Political Editor, just to analyse for us the scale of what happened last Thursday. In tomorrow's edition of The Spectator, James's column looks at how reform won and what this might mean for our country and for the other political parties. James, how momentous do you think those results were?
I think these have been a very important set of local elections because, and you talk to some of the minor parties across the spectrum, it's all been about the phrase breaking the habit, so breaking Britain's addiction, perhaps, or tradition of voting for the two-party system. And what we saw last week, I think, was important because previously, you know, Nigel Farage's political vehicles have all focused mostly on a single cause. So first it was UKIP, then it was the Brexit Party, and now it's reform. And so this was the sense, perhaps, that you could have Farage confined to one issue, you deal with that issue, and he was going to be done. What we saw last week was a much more sort of wholesome sort of critique of Britain, the economy, the state, how it's all going. And what we saw was finally, according to the BBC national projected vote share, reform hitting 30% of the vote, Labour on 20%, and the Conservatives down in fourth on 15%. So what we saw was a really important breakthrough. And what we saw was reform doing much better than sort of UKIP did at their height in, say, 2013, when they were getting 23% of the vote across the country. We saw a much more professional operation. We saw the winning places of the country polling very well that they hadn't either campaigned in, such as Gloucestershire coming second there, or, for instance, doing very well in Merseyside as well, which is an area where sort of non-Labour parties have always struggled with. So I think the reform did very well, but we can obviously ask the man himself here, Zia Youssef, the party chairman. But I'd also want to mention, as my sort of role sometimes as the Liberal Democrat correspondent of The Spectator, Sir Ed Davies' party, because for the very first time, the Liberal Democrats came second in election for council elections across England. So the reform got 677 councillors, clearly won that, but also the Lib Dems got 370 councillors, more than the Conservatives on 319. And I think this is important because I think you're suddenly seeing the Liberal Democrats, as David's been saying quite bullishly, being presented as a real alternative. And if you can give an example of how the Lib Dems and Reform did very well in this election, you'd only look, for instance, at Kent and Durham. You know, you think Kent, you think Southern Tory, the home of Middle England, and obviously Durham, the tradition of the Labour Party, run by Labour for 100 years until 2021. In both of those now, Reform is the main party in control and the Liberal Democrats are second. And that, I think, shows very much how the two-party system is under threat, how well Reform did, and sort of going under the radar perhaps is the Lib Dems. But I would only say that the Spectator does make a difference in its coverage, because we got asked on Saturday, the Today programme asked the education spokesman, Munira Wilson, what she made of her party being the party of the Bowden Belt. And she had to come up with some lines about sort of what it means to be the party of the posh. So that was something we came up with on that. But I think it was a very important set of elections. And I think it's going to be a preview of what we can expect over the next few years as we enter the age of four or even five party politics.
Thank you, James. Zia, the first thing that we have to say is congratulations. It's a remarkable achievement for reform, for a party that didn't exist in this form just 2 years ago. We'll discuss what the ramifications are more broadly for British politics, but obviously sometimes people in studying local elections overlook the fact that councillors having been elected, there are services that they're going to deliver, administrations that they're going to lead. What can people in Durham, in Kent, and in all of the 10 local authority areas where reform are now in charge, what can they expect from reform councillors?
Well, firstly, Michael, thank you for the congratulations, but they are best not directed at me, but to our awesome candidates, over 1,600, of whom fought great campaigns. We won 677 seats across this great country. The congratulations go to our volunteers and our branches and our grassroots who have done so much, and obviously our MPs and Nigel, who led from the front. In terms of how we look forward now, and by the way, I also want to just address James's comment about how important these local elections were. I think they were the most important local set of local elections in the history of this country, because they proved that the century-long stranglehold that the two, what we call the two old parties, have had on British politics has now been decisively broken. We take very seriously the business of governance. You know, we have, as we speak, our councillors are choosing their leaders. They're doing that freely and of their own volition, as you would expect. And we're going to govern in a very different way. You know, we've been very clear about what we wanted to do in local government. We never claimed to be miracle workers, but we did believe that there was waste. So, as Nigel said, if you are a DEI officer, or if you have a sneakily slightly different job title to protect you from FOI requests, you probably should potentially start looking for new work. We're going to resist, emphasis on the word resist, planning applications to turn HMOs into accommodation for illegal migrants, likewise hotels, to the degree that people are trying to turn them into what are effectively hostels. You can expect our team of lawyers to work with our councils to launch legal action to resist that. We're also going to work really hard to ensure that the millions of pounds currently being spent by councils across this country, ostensibly on not fixing potholes, to actually start delivering on fixing some potholes. We're going to, in areas like Lincolnshire, we're going to work hard to ensure that massive areas of greenbelt are not turned into solar farms against the will of local residents. Nothing against solar, by the way, in the sense that if somebody wants to put solar panels on their private homes, cool, without being subsidized by working people, no issue at all. But it's not acceptable that Mad Ed Miliband gets to reshape what we consider our green belt because of his net zero religion. And we're also going to look very carefully at procurement. You know, and this is not a quick win, but I think that most of the problems that ail this country, if you keep asking why, you end up in a place where it's because procurement is done catastrophically poorly. So we're going to work very hard on that matter as well. I think I personally spent a lot of time looking at the thousands of FOI responses that we got to the thousands of requests that our team put in this year. And it's very hard getting real answers because it's like getting blood out of a stone. But it's clear that multi-million pound contracts are being awarded by councils now that we're in control of, without any real competition, where there's only one bidder. And there's nothing about that that's remotely acceptable. So one principle we will look to uphold in our reform-controlled councils is we will look to spend taxpayer money in the same way we would spend our own. And if you were going to get your driveway done, if you were going to get some work done in your garden or put a loft extension in, you wouldn't just get one bid. You'd probably get more than one. And so those are these sort of common sense initiatives that we are launching. You'd have probably seen an initiative around the flag, so you'll see a multitude of our councils, probably in their first council meetings, resolved to ensure that the flag to foreign countries or around many other woke causes are no longer permitted to be flown on council premises. I think that's a very reasonable position. So, look, we're going to take a very common sense approach to local governance. We're very excited about... I've had calls now, Zoom calls with every single group of winning councillors. We're going to bring, interestingly, we're actually bringing all of our winning councillors to this very room next Sunday in our inaugural Centre of Excellence for Councillors meeting. Most of our councillors have no prior experience in elected office. We view that as a good thing, as Trump says, a good thing, not a bad thing, on the basis that they've had no hand in the damage that is caused by the previous incumbent. But we're very excited about what we're going to achieve for the British people. And I'll say this too, that we are well aware that the levers of power held by local government pale in comparison to the ones held in Westminster. Obviously, our ambition is for Nigel to get the keys to number 10 Downing Street and for us to have 350 to 400 Reform MPs in 2029. We will pull those levers of power that are available to us with all of our might in the direction of patriotism, in the direction of listening to our constituents. Frankly, in light of the news today now about, you know, the India trade deal and what's happening now with NI, running every decision we make through the lens of what is in the best interests of our constituents, which is actually quite a, frankly, I think, quite revolutionary prospect, given the way this country and local communities have been governed over the last two decades.
We'll come back to some of those questions, including the India trade deal, very current in a moment. But I wanted to turn to Jacob now. And Jacob, just ask you, why do you think the local election results were as they were? And what advice would you give to colleagues in the Conservative Party about how to respond?
Well, I think the local elections were clearly on national issues rather than local issues. I don't think people were voting because they thought their local councillor in an individual ward was good or bad. I think they were voting on the national scene. And the national scene was, by the last general election, and has been confirmed since the general election, that whoever you vote for, you get much the same thing. That actually the budget we did, our last budget, could broadly have been done by Rachel Reeves, and that the green agenda has unchanged. I mean, Miliband's going a bit further than we went, but not much. The renters reform stuff that you were doing, which I loathed, I'm sorry to tell you, is being pushed ahead with socialist enthusiasm by the new government. And people looked at us and looked at Labour and thought, well, it doesn't make a lot of difference. And I think that's been a real problem. I think it's very hard for a new leader to suddenly change that, because we've had this feeling of, and Nigel has put this very well, of a uniparty. And if you look at what's happening, not just in this country, but in America, people are absolutely fed up with the business as usual. They're fed up with the feeling that however you vote, it doesn't change things. And they've now voted in a way that they think will change things. Now, it won't, actually, because, as Zia was very sensibly pointing out, most of the levers of power in Westminster are not in local government. So, yes, they can change the flags, but an awful lot of the duties of local councils are statutory duties that they have to carry out. Regrettably, they won't be able to get rid of as much DEI as I would like them to, because they have, as a public body, the public sector equalities duty that's laid down in law. They'll be endlessly taken to court if they don't follow it. So there's not going to be a big change on how we're governed immediately because of this, but it is a reflection of the deep fed-upness of the electorate, and to my mind, understandable fed-upness. What advice would I give? The advice I would give to the Conservative Party is to be conservative and get back to what we're meant to do, which is to be on the side of the people who vote for us. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you take net zero has given us the most expensive energy in Europe, particularly electricity prices. Our industrial electricity is four times the cost of energy in the United States. This is making people cold and poor. Why on earth would we be going along with that? It's crazy policy, and it makes no difference to the world anyway, because we're only 0.9% of emissions. We went along with the fashionable internationalist view of the world and accepted that for too long at the cost of our constituents. And that was fine in its way when everyone was prosperous. Once the economic climate became more difficult, that changed. We also have gone along with a lot of woke sensibilities. But just think how cautious we were when we were in government over Black Lives Matter, which was all absolute nonsense. It was nothing to do with the UK. It was an American issue to do with American policing. And we were tiptoeing around it as if it had something to do with the United Kingdom. It didn't. And Colston Gay's statue was not Colston Gay, his friend of mine, wrong, the Colston statue was pulled out, the statue in Bristol. Colston's statue was pulled down, and the law wasn't enforced properly to stop it. It was absolutely feeble, and we were in charge, and people thought, this just isn't good enough. So we need to be conservative, we need to stand up for what we believe in, we need to stand up for the country, for the success of Britain, for our amazing historical achievements, and we need to stand up making people better off. And then I think people may begin to listen to us again.
Many of the points that you make, I sensed Zia would have agreed with, and might even say had been articulated more strongly or more clearly in the last couple of years by Nigel Farage. What would you say to someone who, say, Jacob, I absolutely trust you, and I'd love to have you in Parliament again, but many of your colleagues just alluded to some of the lefty policies followed by Michael Gove. Many of your colleagues...
Sorry about that.
No. Many of you, quite right, many of your colleagues, you know, deserve actually slightly longer to, you know, reflect and think on their errors. Given everything you've said, we're going to give reform a go. Because as you yourself said, reform can change some things in local government, but we can only get real change if there's change at Westminster, and that's the biggest change that we can see.
Yes, I mean, I think, and Zia will have to disagree with me, but we need to get a collaboration between the Conservatives and Reform. And we as Conservatives have to recognise that these elections were a huge victory for Conservatism, but not for the Conservative Party. They were a victory for views that Conservatives hold. And I don't buy into James's analysis so much on the Lib Dems, because what did well for the Lib Dems is where they came through, where the Tories and Reform split the vote. That was the main thing. The Lib Dem vote, and it depends who you believe, and different people give different percentages for these elections, but the BBC, which we will normally not quote as a source of authority, but on this occasion I will, the BBC says that what they got in 2021 and 2025 was the same national percentage share. It wasn't a big rise in Lib Demery, it was a big fall in conservatism. And that's really important because that shows where the Conservatives should be going. And those siren voices in the Conservative Party who say, oh, what about all these people going Lib Dem? They're the wrong people to be listening to.
I think one of the points that James has brought out in his reporting is that whatever one thinks of the Lib Dems and their policies, the Lib Dem face that's been offered to the electorate has been a very Middle England one. So Ed Davies celebrated his election victory by watching a village cricket match and drinking Pimm's. So in a way, he's seeking to present himself as a conservative small C as possible. He may even be taking out a Spectator subscription next, for all we know. But Zia, Jacob's outlined what he believes might be a fruitful way forward, but you would be sceptical?
I wouldn't be sceptical. I think it's a non-starter. I think, look, I think Parliament would be better off with somebody like Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg in it. I genuinely believe that. I think you're a very honourable man. But I do find it very difficult to square the circle around, you know, everything you just said about net zero. And yet, I believe you're on the record as saying one of the biggest mistakes the Conservative Party ever made was removing Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson, I put it to you, you would struggle to find a greater zealot for net zero than Boris Johnson. He was the person who said one of the most extraordinary phrases any Prime Minister has ever said was something about the Saudi Arabia of wind, turning Britain into the Saudi Arabia of wind. So I find it very difficult to square that circle. Obviously, people are well aware of this now concept of the Boris wave. I think there's even potentially a Wikipedia entry around that of the enormous numbers of people who came to the UK under his prime ministership from outside the EU. A tiny fraction on work visas. So I think that's the reason why now, not your personal brand, but the brand of the Conservative Party and the Tory brand is broken. And we live in a world now where a young startup can make big moves very quickly. It wasn't that long ago. I mean, I remember prior to the general election, I'm quite new to politics, and prior to the last year's general election, when I said to Nigel, I want to do whatever I can to get you elected in Clacton-on-Sea, he was priced at around, I think it was about 35% to win his seat in Clacton. He's now priced closer to 38% to be the next Prime Minister. And one of the things that has happened is the, I think, extinction event of the Conservative Party. If we look at the just the numbers, so as you said, if you look at the vote share, the computed vote share from the BBC, who are not necessarily structurally set up to be predisposed to overstate reforms numbers, given one of our commitments is to scrap the license fee, they said that, you know, they put us on about 30%. They put the Tories on 20, and they Labour on 20, and they put the Tories on 15. There was a YouGov poll that came out today. YouGov, pretty good at polling. They put us at 29%. They put the Conservative Party 1 point ahead of the Liberal Democrats. And you say the face of the Liberal Democrats. I would argue the face of the Liberal Democrats is Ed Davey doing TikToks, dancing in the most thermonuclear, cringeworthy fashion, challenging Keir Starmer to a FIFA match with his head sort of morphing into Shrek. I mean, that's where we are in British politics. And for all of the intellectual heft of Jacob, the reality is that people simply do not believe anything that the Tories say anymore. And one of the things I've always found interesting too is that in politics, people, I came from a background of being an entrepreneur in tech. And so perhaps I've a slightly more asymmetric perspective on the world that we live in today about how quickly something very small can become quite big. And so if you like take ChatGPT, do you know how long it took ChatGPT to get to 100 million users? Anyone want to guess? Shout out how many years? It was 2 months. It took 2 months for ChatGPT to get to 100 million users. Took Spotify, which I put it to almost everyone in this room house, pretty modern company, took them 11 years. And so that is the scale of exponential change. And in Nigel, we have someone who I think is the most formidable politician, British politician of our lifetimes. We have amazing MPs behind him. And all we're really doing, we're doing our best to just listen to people in Britain, say things that are true. Most of us aren't career politicians. I'm frankly quite a reluctant politician. I came from the world of business. And so far it's resonating well. And I think, as I said, 14 years of Tory rule in which they, you know, they promised in four consecutive manifestos to reduce net migration down to the tens of thousands and left office with that number at over a million, according to the ONS. There are consequences to that. And I think the notion that you can get away with that when there is something like reform that exists, that wouldn't have happened, you know, in the era of Thatcher, etc., that didn't exist. I think this is an extinction event for the Conservative Party. Just to be clear, I also am well aware we have a huge amount of work to do as reform. We don't take anything for granted. We're not complacent at all. We're going to work our socks off to deliver for every single voter who voted for us on May the 1st. But we're very confident we're going to be able to deliver. And I remain more confident than ever that Nigel will be our next Prime Minister.
Thanks, Ian. Thank you. Looking ahead, and I'll come back to deal with one or two of the important issues that you and Jacob have raised in policy terms, but Lucy has been looking ahead at the elections to come. And of course, there'll be big elections in Scotland and Wales, as well as other local elections in a year's time, which, if anything, will be an even bigger test for all of the established parties and perhaps an even bigger opportunity for reform. Lucy, it's impossible to predict with accuracy, but how are things looking based on opinion polls and on your intelligence on what's happening on the ground?
Yeah, just when you think you're out of one set of elections, we've had the July national general election last year, we've had the local elections just there, we've got the Holyrood elections in the Scottish Parliament next year, and we've got the Welsh Parliament elections too. Yeah, I think it's shaping up pretty interestingly, actually, in looking at the conversation we've had tonight about reform and the surge in England, I think next year we'll see how things are shaping up in Scotland and Wales. And I think what is fascinating now, if you look, for example, to Scotland, which is an area I you know, cover quite frequently, given that's where I'm from. I know quite a lot about, for example, the nationalist circles there that have seen their support, you know, I would say sort of go up and down, fluctuate over the last couple of years, given what's going on with Nicola Sturgeon, we had Hamza Yusuf, we've now got John Swinney. When you look at the unionist parties, there was definitely a thought maybe about a year ago that support was beginning to pick up a bit more, that Scottish Labour leader Anna Sarwar could be in a good position to be First Minister potentially in 2026. Now, however, and I think a lot of this is probably down to the surge of support for reform north of the border, the unionist parties are looking much weaker. I think there's a poll that came out today, and it was by Servation, a polling company that it showed that Reform UK, now in Scotland, could become the largest party of the opposition in Holyrood. Similar polling you see for the Senedd in Wales. Mm. I think that says quite a lot about the strength of the Reform, but also the weakness of the unionist opposition. And actually, these two elections next year could shape up to be elections that are very much a face-off between nationalist parties, whether that be the SNP or Plaid Cymru, against Reform UK.
Yes.
And I think actually what we're seeing is a number of things. When you look at the Scottish Tories, you know, they don't seem to have gained as much momentum as they could have post the general election, and that's a problem for them. And Reform is cutting into people that would count themselves as being Conservative voters. But actually, speaking to Zia's colleagues up north of the border, the next sort of challenge that they're looking at, and very much almost pushing past the Reform Tory splits and sort of that kind of competition, they're now looking at Labour as being their main competitors. And their message is, you know, if you want to vote for someone that is going to take on the SNP, if you want to vote for a unionist party, ignore the Tories, ignore Labour because they don't really know what they stand for north of the border, and go for reform. And actually, I think that message is cutting through, particularly in working class areas. Look at Glasgow, there's a lot of support in different areas across in the central belt. And I think it's something that is quite interesting, seeing that support consistently pick up in polls. And I think, you know, even when you look at Labour support as well, that's gone, you know, almost it's crumbled in the last couple of months. That's Labour supporters going off to Reform, but also, you know, to sort of the SNP as well, just because they don't feel that the traditional unionist parties in Scotland are offering them much of a message. I think that's something that is definitely going to be interesting to keep an eye on. I think I would also make the point, and we didn't see it so much in the local elections. I think if you look at turnout, it was around about what would be expected, so around about 35% on average. So, you know, voter apathy maybe wasn't really the story of the local elections, but certainly looking at turnout from the general election last year, it's going to be something that I think pollsters will keep their eye on when you look at Holyrood and the Senedd. And I think there is a huge degree of voter disillusionment still and a lot of distrust with politicians. Ipsos polling has shown that I think, you know, trust in politicians right now is around about 10% when you look at some cohorts of the population. And I'd be very interested to see how that does affect Reform down the line, because right now Reform is seen by many as an anti-establishment party, but picking up a number of councillors and probably going to make significant gains next year, it'll be interesting to see how Reform deals with that challenge as well.
So, yeah, given what Lucy said, and it does seem to be the case at the moment that in Wales it's Plaid Cymru versus Reform, they're the top two. In Scotland, in the latest poll, it's the SNP with Reform as the just principal opponent. Would Reform campaign in these elections to get rid of the Senedd in Cardiff and to get rid of the Scottish Parliament at Edinburgh?
No, we wouldn't. Look, generally, most people at Reform think the changes that Tony Blair made were not necessarily for the betterment of the country, but what we do believe is that the Senedd, I mean, you look at Wales and you look at the NHS in Wales, and you look at the education system in Wales, and you basically have third world statistics. And it pains me to say that. You know, we have a situation in Wales where the elective waiting lists are around about between 40 and 50% longer than England. And England is already a disaster. Then you have the educational attainment of 13-year-old children in Wales around in English, in mathematics and science. And they are below the OECD average, and that's a result of north of two decades of Labour rule. So one thing that I don't think people have factored in their thinking in those areas is the power of Nigel Farage wandering around campaigning. People forget in the general election last year, Nigel spent most of his time in Clacton. You know, and this is the most formidable campaigner, arguably, ever in British history. You could make a compelling case that that is true. I certainly believe it's true. And you better believe he will be campaigning around Wales, which voted to leave, where his approval ratings are very strong. And already most polls put us neck and neck in terms of Wales. Scotland, you know, we're just about, as you said, in the latest polls, nudging ourselves into the primary opposition. But these are nations that have been, I think, catastrophically neglected, horrifically misgoverned. And, you know, so when people say, oh, how are reform afraid? People seem to think that we're afraid of the fact that we've just won some councils. No, we're not afraid. We worked our socks off to achieve this. Well, look, we're realistic. As Nigel said, we don't have a magic wand, but we do believe there are significant savings to be made in terms of money being wasted. We think we can bring a totally new approach to the way we govern. And again, if you think about most policies that have been enacted over the last 20 years in this country, most of them have not been computed through an algorithm of what is in the best interests of our constituents. I was on Good Morning Britain a couple of mornings ago, and Ed Balls asked me, well, how would you fund the... would you reinstate the winter fuel allowance? I said, yes. He said, how would you fund it? I said, foreign aid. He said, oh. Yeah, out of foreign aid. We spend 10 times more on foreign aid in this country every year than the supposed savings on winter fuel. And having spent a lot of time in Runcorn and Helsby across the constituency, particularly in the area of Runcorn, knocking on doors, I heard the word betrayal a lot. And that word is often associated, and please forgive me, present company, but obviously it's used a lot in the context of 14 years of Tory rule and people who voted Tory. But these were not Tory voters. These were people who voted Labour last year. I remember in one case, it was a lady who had just become a pensioner. She had voted Labour her entire life, and she said she's now borrowing money from her grandson to pay her bills as a result of the withdrawal of the winter fuel allowance. So when we think about what the bar is for reform, you know, it's often set out that the bar is some sort of total transformation to a golden age for Britain in Lincolnshire within 2 weeks. That's not the bar. The bar is simply prioritizing your own constituents, the people who voted for you, who placed their trust in you, who thought you stood for certain things, just to fight for those people. And that is the bar. And I think we'll dramatically surpass that.
You touched here earlier on one issue where Nigel Farage has been making hay in the last 24 hours, which is the India trade deal that the Labour government has concluded. And he's been arguing that is, precisely as you say, a betrayal of the people for whom the government should be standing up. But Jacob, again, I don't want to lead the witness, as it were. You take a slightly different view, and you see in the trade deal actually perhaps that rare thing, a Starmer win, or more to the point, a British win that's occurred on Starmer's watch. But over to you.
Well, I would get rid of all tariffs on all goods. Tariffs harm British consumers, and they don't protect British industry. The argument about British industry, and whether this is ceramics or steel, is that we have a crazy energy policy that is putting British industry out of business. We don't make British industry competitive by putting tariffs on. We make British industry competitive by getting rid of the burdens that we have been placing on it. And this applies to our farmers, who are ridiculously overregulated. It applies to heavy industry that has very high costs to pay. So on the straight tariffs on goods coming into the United Kingdom, I'm delighted that they're going, and this will make tea a little bit cheaper and rice a little bit cheaper and prawns a little bit cheaper. This is what we promised in Brexit. This is all good news, and we couldn't have done it whilst we were in the European Union. So cheaper prices of food, clothing and footwear is a Brexit win. Whether it was necessary to do this, because we could have done that unilaterally, to give anything on visas is a completely different matter. For a reduction in tariffs to 40%, on Scottish whisky is a different question. So it's perfectly reasonable to say that this deal doesn't go far enough, that there's more that should have been done, but we should simply get rid of tariffs on coming into this country, and we should get rid of non-tariff barriers as well. Some of you may have read in the newspapers that some processed chicken sold by Asda had to be withdrawn because it was likely to give people a nasty dose of food poisoning. Had this had a very good, healthy chlorine wash, it wouldn't have continued to have this bacteria on it, and people could have eaten it safely, and Asda wouldn't have had the loss of withdrawing it. So we want to get rid of non-tariff barriers as well. And I think it's quite likely, and you'd know better than I do because you were in the government at the time, that if we'd got this deal before the election, we would have been quite keen to sign it and have a deal with India going into a general election, I think the Tories would have been pleased about.
I will reveal exactly what would have happened in next week's Spectator. But in the meantime, Zia, you don't take quite as sanguine a view. Why is it that you think that this is a bad deal?
Well, look, firstly, I totally agree with Jacob that we want fewer tariffs, we want less tariffs. Free trade is a great thing. But the notion that, look, what as a direct result of this trade deal, if you're an Indian multinational, it is considerably cheaper to transfer a member of staff from India to the UK than it is to hire a British worker. And this comes not in isolation, Jacob. It comes from...
Is it really, though?
Yeah, it is.
There is a saving on national insurance,
yeah.
But you've got to move the person from India to here. You've got to pay their living costs. That when you take the add-on costs of transferring somebody, that is much more expensive than employing somebody domestically against employers' and employees' national insurance.
Well, you're making some assumptions there about what particular package an employer is going to make. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this deal is the point about national insurance, well, it's bilateral, as if the economics there are going to make sense. And so what comes up time and time again, I can tell you with a high degree of confidence, if Nigel was negotiating this deal as our Prime Minister, he would have stood up for British workers. And by the way, again, I want to emphasise this. This deal, this point that is being made, is not being made in isolation. It is being made after a horrendous sequence and conveyor belt, the British workers being subordinated to foreign workers time and time and time again. And frankly, British people have had enough of it. Yes, we are going to focus on the fact that the idea that British employers, whom we've met many, of whom we have met many over the last few months on the campaign trail, who are buckling under the pressure of the hike on national insurance, that's the work, obviously, of the Labour Party, having never put that in their manifesto, having met many people, for example, on benefits, who say, we want to work, we would love to actually start working a little bit, but we can't, because if we start working more than 16 hours a week, as a result of the way the benefits and taxation system, the nexus of that means the marginal rate of tax is north of 100%. They literally have less money at the end of the month if they start going to work. I mean, this stuff is bonkers. It's absolutely bananas. And yet, there isn't even a serious conversation about any of this stuff. So that's why people care about this stuff, Jacob. Look, of course, a free trade deal is a good thing. And by the way, we should have done so many of these so quickly. The reason why the promise of Brexit, the opportunity of Brexit, has been betrayed to such a degree is because those trade deals were not done. The regulatory burden on British businesses, frankly, the current leader of the Conservative Party was the person more responsible for that than anybody, because she refused to take a lot of those statutes off our books on the basis that, and I quote, she is a Conservative and not an arsonist. And I don't think history would necessarily agree with that statement. So, look, yes, we need to do more free trade deals. I think we've got a massive opportunity by now, more than ever, actually, as a result of Trump's policies from being outside the European Union. But a bright red line, I can tell you, that will be drawn under a Nigel Farage prime ministership, was it will never, ever be cheaper to import a foreign worker than to hire a British worker.
Quick test of opinion here, Spectator readers, amongst the most learned and judicious figures in British life. I'm going to ask you to put your hands up, first of all, if you agree with Jacob that overall it's a good thing, this trade deal. And then, those of you who agree with Zia, that overall this particular deal is a bad thing. So hands up, first of all, those who agree with Jacob. Fair few. Hands up those who agree with Zia. I think Zia aces it just.
I think Zia wins.
But it's interesting.
But I think this
finally
is
finally balanced.
I think there's one very interesting thing about this, and that is the politics of it for Keir Starmer, partly because of the national insurance thing in relation to national insurance just having gone up, which the timing of which is very bad. But I think a trade deal with India is something most people would have given their eye teeth for at any point in recent years until yesterday. And that this is luck of politics. And Keir Starmer has turned out to be an unlucky politician. And almost anything he does is now failing. And that's something that everyone should have said, this is incredible. The EU's been negotiating with India for 30 years or whatever it is, and it can't get a trade deal. He's come along, he's done it, he should have got a positive feel. And instead, everything Keir does turns to ashes and wormwood. And that's really important politically and terrible for the Labour Party. It's very hard, and we know this only too well, this is very hard for parties to recover from. It's like the major government after the exchange rate mechanism. It's like us after we got rid of Boris. Even when you do things that would otherwise have been popular, they fail. And Starmer and the Labour Party are in that position, I think.
This week, the Spectator's cover feature is about something that one of our writers, brilliant young writer called Gus Carter, calls Scuzz Nation. And he homes in on the sense amongst many people that antisocial behaviour goes unpunished. Shoplifting is on the rise. Public drug taking. The way in which you can see no effective penalty for those people who are responsible for essentially despoiling the public square. And that sense of anger that if you refuse to go along with this and if you do the right thing, that you might be viewed as a mug, is something that's come up again and again in words that canvassers record and words that opinion pollsters report from focus groups and elsewhere. And I wanted to ask Jacob and Zia, and then invite reflections from Lucy and James as well. To what extent do you think there is that sense of public disquiet about visiting a town or village high street and seeing the fact that the traditional liveliness has been replaced by barbers that are acting as moneylenders, vape shops that are feeding teen addiction, vacant lots that distant landlords can't be bothered to fill, and at the same time, where once there would have been the reassuring presence of a policeman or another authority figure, now you or I would worry if our female relatives or friends were to be on that street much after dark.
Well, other than a defence of landlords who don't like having vacant lots because they like getting the rent for it. I mean, he is an old lefty on landlords. It's extraordinary. Anyway, brushing over that, just go and walk along Great Peter Street.
Yeah.
I do not want my daughter, who is 16, walking along Great Peter Street after dark. There are drunks, there are drug addicts, there are very often ambulances picking people up out of the street. And this is within a few hundred yards of the Palace of Westminster and the centre of our democracy, and there are actually a few police around here. Just go up Park Lane. Park Lane's disgusting. What is going on? We've got a shanty town in Park Lane. I used to be an emerging markets investor, and I would go off to countries, third world countries, and this is what you would see there, and this is happening in London, in one of the great cities of the world. Other than not being in Somerset, it would be the best city in the world. Bath and Wells being the two great cities of the world. This is absolutely dreadful. And what is going on? Why aren't the police enforcing the law? Why are the police arresting people for tweeting? Why have we got a woke approach to policing that means the baddies are getting away with it? Theresa May, meaning that people don't get arrested for stealing under £200 worth when they're shoplifting. Why on earth was a Conservative government doing this? We want the police arresting shoplifters. The policeman in Manchester is doing extraordinarily well by actually enforcing the law, but we want this to happen in London. So Michael asks me if I think people feel this. I feel this. I see it as I go around London, and it's an absolute disgrace. It's a terrible situation for us to be in. And actually, the rough sleeping problem was dealt with during COVID. Everyone was moved off the streets. The streets were made safe in that sense. Tony Blair managed to deal with rough sleeping. It is possible to do. And crime needs enforcement. We've got to take our drugs laws seriously as well. That currently we have lots of drugs laws that nobody seems to care about. And people seem to take drugs as willy-nilly. And this, I think, should be stopped. I think we should, either we decide we're not going to have the laws, which I think would be a mistake, or we enforce the laws that we've got. Otherwise, I think the feeling that there is the poor motorist who gets done for 22 and a half miles an hour whilst the shoplifter's getting off scot-free, I think it creates a real feeling of unfairness, of two-tier justice, and this should be something that the Conservatives should be arguing about very strongly.
Zia?
Yeah. Once again, I have the cognitive dissonance of simultaneously completely agreeing with everything Jacob just said, but wishing to compare it to the Conservative Party's record. We know we don't need to speculate about what a Conservative Party would do. And again, I say that with all due respect to Jacob. Look, we live in a country where, I mean, look, let's take law and order. We just talked about that. The Tory party over their 14 years in government expanded the size of the population to the tune of 6.5 million net new people through immigration. And do you know how many new prison places they built? Anyone want to guess? 455, to be specific. And the reason we know that is because a Conservative MP actually asked in the House of Commons, which is funny in and of itself. But what's not funny is the fact that in any longitudinal study of criminology across the world, cross-culturally, transnationally, in any large population, a very small proportion will be criminal, a fraction of that will be violently criminal, and sadly cannot be rehabilitated. These people must be locked up, lest the population will not be safe. And we simply do not have enough prison capacity, just in the same way we have nowhere near enough hospital beds. And so we are now in a situation also where, again, in no small part, frankly, driven by the Conservative Party, during their time in governance. We don't have a police force, we have a police service. A reform government will bring back, it won't be a police service, it will be a police force. They will be incentivized and judged on how many criminals they arrest. We'll have a judiciary that actually put criminals in jail. There's a man who actually holds the record, I understand, for the most number of crimes, having never served a day in prison. He's been convicted of over 100 crimes. He's notched up a century of crimes and yet not served a single day in prison. If you, how many of you, can you indulge me? Could people raise their hands? If you, when you take your phone out in public, you clutch it particularly tightly. How many people do that? The only people who don't have their hands up probably don't own a phone. So the reason you do that is because of this statistic. And whether you're aware of the statistic or not, you know it in your bones. The chances, if you steal somebody's phone, the chances that you are even identified as a suspect, not arrested, not convicted, nor going to jail, it's less than 1%. So we have a police force that, for in many instances, has sadly failed, no longer takes crime seriously in many regards. And so that's what we need to reinitiate. We need a real police force. We need to be willing to say, look, crime needs to be punished. People need to not only be arrested, we need a judiciary that actually convicts people and puts them in jail. Again, this is actually quite revolutionary stuff. And when I said the bar is low in terms of governance, that's what a reform government will do. In terms of high streets, look, I think high streets are actually really, really important. Maybe because I have nostalgic memories of Woolworths and places like that. But, you know, walking around in Runcorn, the number of times people on the doorstep said, you know, that they're living in a 2 or 3 bedroom semi-detached home, and they said, look, my kids, there's no bowling alley for them, there's no cinema, there's literally nothing for them to go and do. If I want to go to the pub, my nearest pub now is 7 miles away by car. And that is what has happened. So many of these communities have been totally left behind and hollowed out. And I do think these are serious questions that we need to ask as a country about how do we revivify a community spirit. And I just don't think that's been done now in decades.
James, Lucy, is there any indication that the government understands this depth of disquiet?
I think the sort of parallel is with, you know, the 1970s and stepping stones, where you sort of start to analyse what's wrong with Britain and you end up in a sort of, you know, bag of wool, almost pulling at every bit. I think what we're seeing now when we look at, for instance, the sort of social scarring on the high street is the visible consequences from really the failure to grow the economy for the past 20 years or so. I think 30 years before 2008, productivity rose at 2.2% a year. Since 2008, it's been about 0.3% a year. So we have just failed to grow for a generation. And what you are seeing is the visible decline, particularly compared to other nations around the world, which are sort of growing at a much faster rate. So that's the first point, is the sort of no economics. The second point, of course, is then that manifests itself in political terms. And that's why you see a lot more volatility. That's why you see voters willing to embrace many different sort of alternatives in government, you know, because you have, for instance, sort of Labour MPs come on writing this weekend about how, you know, in office reform will find it very different. Well, voters are turning around and saying, well, what we like already, we can see the visible decline of our neighbourhood. We don't like what's on offer. And I think, frankly, that overestimates perhaps some of those local authorities and how good a job they've done. So they're willing to roll the dice on that. And the third point I'd just say is about when you see all this stuff and hearing, you know, listening to all everyone talk about the sort of anger they feel about the visible decline about in different communities, motivation is going to be key in five-party politics. If you are scrapping over a couple of percentages of vote, which under first past the post is a winner-all-take system, it is important to motivate your base and to reflect on the local elections. Speaking to Conservative campaigners and speaking to Labour campaigners, motivation was a clearly important thing, whereas reform obviously had built this narrative, Britain is broken, Britain needs reform, and I think that was to get their vote out. So I think that all these things are going to be really important. Seeing that on the sort of micro level in local communities is one thing, but there are also big macro questions, and that's why we're going to see over the next 4 years reform building up this kind of steady series of sort of upscaling. Local elections this year, Wales and Scotland next, 2029, Downing Street.
And Lucy, there's been specifically some talk recently, speculation about a government reshuffle. Who might we expect to see promoted in any government reshuffle? Who, in your understanding, do the leaders of the Labour Party believe are the figures in the next generation equipped to deal with the challenges we've been discussing?
Well, yeah, and just before that, I think I would just sort of back up what James has said about, you know, in many ways, the issues, I think, that are tied into the cover of the Spectator magazine this week, yes, also then come back to what we've seen with the local elections and people on the streets talking about lack of trust in politicians, because they got told at the election, not only were they promised the world and that things were going to get better, not only have things not gotten better, actually they're seeing things visibly get worse. And I think that that is, you know, that social contract between voter and politician is breaking down at a faster rate in many ways than we'd even realised. And I think, you know, only 10 months into a Labour government and we're seeing types of comments, I think in Runcorn, I was there for a couple of days, and lots of people were saying, you know, at the general election, wasn't particularly enthused about Labour, and now at this point, I don't think I'm ever going to vote for them again. So I think, you know, there's quite a turnaround there. In terms of how the government goes forward with this, you know, there's been lots of chat at the weekends about whether, you know, Bridget Phillipson will remain in post, whether the Culture Secretary and the department itself will remain in play. And I suppose that type of thing, I think, you know, to a degree, it'll be interesting to see how that does shape up. But certainly it feels as though, I think, on the ground, that voters themselves don't really have that same connection with the politicians that they voted in, and as a result are just turning off from politics altogether.
Lucy, thank you. I'll go now to the audience. Before I invite questions, just another instant poll. Hands up anyone who thinks, do you know what, I actually feel safer going about my business than I did 10 years ago. And then can I invite you to put your hands up if you think, thinking about my neighbourhood, it has definitely gone downhill in the last 10 years.
You must move to Somerset.
Yes. Anyone who takes a different view, anyone who would say, actually think about my neighbourhood, it's you know,
it's Somerset.
Yeah, it's a gentleman over there, probably from Somerset. there we go. Okay, that's... You know, it's an unscientific poll, but over to you. Questions. Who'd like to go first? Yes, gentleman in the second row.
I've been voting for over 50 years, and in that time, the two main political parties were themselves coalitions, sometimes friendly coalitions, often warring coalitions. We've just seen a massive majority given to a government which got 20% of the available votes. Would we actually be better off now if we had coalition governments representing more of the people of this country?
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And there was a young lady just behind you, just slightly to the right. Yes, just there. Yes, in the I think sort of tangerine top.
Thank you, Michael. Question: there was someone who said that the current Conservative MPs and the previous lot of Conservative MPs are really Liberal Democrats. I totally agree. What do you think?
Okay. And yes, the gentleman there in the front row, I think, is... Yeah.
So we've had some talk about what if Nigel reaches number 10 at the next election. Reform's historically supported proportional representation, and I think it's best-case scenario for Reform. Unlikely they'll get near 50% of the vote. So if they should win, they'll be winning because of first-past-the-post. Will they still be supporting proportional representation in that scenario, or will things change?
Great. So and I'll go further into the body of the coat, further back, for the next round of questions. But, Zia, questions about coalitions and PR stroke first-past-the-post, essentially the same sort of territory, but also are most Conservative MPs really Lib Dems?
So let's start start with the two questions, but largely the same two questions. I'll speak personally. I came into politics about a year ago, just under a year ago, because I love this country. It's served, it's given me so much opportunity. A lot of my friends were leaving the country. I'd sold my company a couple of years ago. I could have done the same, but I'd much rather stay and fight. And I saw in Nigel, a politician, when he said he was going to come back and take over the leadership of Reform UK and run to be an MP in Clacton, a prodigious and almost singular talent in British politics that had the capacity to help turn this country around. And not only do I think it can be saved from all of the things, the ailments that we've talked about this evening, but I think it can once again be one of the most poised, prosperous and powerful countries in the world. To do that, it will take a first pass, us winning under a first-past-the-post system, all the egregious damage that has happened constitutionally in this country, a country that has no written constitution, has happened as a result of the first-past-the-post system. I firmly believe, and I'm speaking personally here, I think if PR was ever instituted in this country, we will end up in a state of gridlock. We will not be able to do the, frankly, quite ambitious and in some cases radical things by the time we get to 2029 that we're going to need to do to unshackle the British economy from the crazy over-regulation, to unleash the potential of British ingenuity. So no, look, we are firmly in favour of first past the post. And look, I've been talking about this for months. I've said, you know, it's funny that it is now being put to me that the cap on Reform support is 50%. It was only about 10 months ago I was being told that Nigel Farage parties had a natural cap of around 15%. And so, look, we've got a lot of work to do, but we've always said we've got to play the game as it is, and that's what we intend to do. Do not be surprised, and I would fully expect, as we home in on 2029, if we continue to poll at 29, 30% or more, that the howls for proportional representation will grow. You'll get a crazy inversion. But I think if we get PR, the other thing I'd say about PR too is that you're going to get this, you know, this sort of Gaza vote will end up becoming entrenched in British politics, and one shouldn't forget that. So I don't think it served Germany particularly well. I don't think it's serving France particularly well. So no is the answer. I personally think that we need first past the post, and that's what Reform intends to win under. In terms of the question around... remind me of the second question.
Are most Conservative MPs really Liberal Democrats?
I don't know about most. I think it's quite clear. We've always had the view that
Well, certainly I've had the view since I came into politics, and we've talked about this a lot over the last year, that the Conservative Party has a fundamental, insoluble physics problem, that about half the party would be better off in the Liberal Democrats, and the other half of the party are perhaps more like Jacobs, you know, small-c Conservatives with whom we certainly share a lot in common in terms of values. And if that is true, it doesn't matter. You know, one can criticise Cammy Badenoch, and I know we have, but the reality is, no matter whom the leader is of the Conservative Party, they will never be able to resolve that. I'd encourage you, go listen to Rishi Sunak's interview with Nick Robinson a few months ago. He basically said that. He said, I couldn't stop the votes because I simply didn't have the support. And that's a really important point, too. It's why we can't have a merger with the Conservative Party, why we believe we must have and we will have 350 to 400 turquoise-blooded Reform MPs flanking Nigel Farage as Prime Minister. And if we have that, then we will be able to stop the boats. We'll be able to cut net migration to zero. We'll be able to do the things we need to do in terms of law and order, rapidly building new detention capacity to ensure criminals are locked up. You cannot do any of those things if you have a divided party. And sadly, for the Conservative Party, and perhaps happily for us at Reform, the Tories will never have that. Jacob?
The first question is obviously right, that all parties are coalitions to some degree, and this will be true of Reform as well, just inevitably. I think it's much more honest to present a political party that is a coalition on a first-past-the-post basis rather than to do the coalition after people have voted, because then they get something nobody voted for at all, whereas at least with first-past-the-post you get what a plurality has voted for. So yes, we're all coalitions, inevitably, but that is much, much better than the smoke-filled rooms after the election type cobbling together. Are some Tory MPs basically Lib Dems? may I plead the Fifth Amendment? But at least I'm not guilty personally, I think. And will Reform abandon PR if they're successful? Well, Zia's already given the game away. Bear in mind the Liberals in the Speaker's Conference that took place in 1918-1919 were not in favour of reforming the electoral system because they still thought then they could win general elections. PR is for losers, if I may channel my inner Trump. And therefore, if Reform turns out to be a winning party, of course it won't go for PR. And if we had PR, it would be the rule of the blob in secula seculorum, and I would be very, very firmly against that.
I think the mood of the hall is with you. More questions, please. Yes, and there is a gentleman in, I think, the second or third row for the bank in a blue blazer and I think a pastel shirt. Yes, sir.
Thank you. We're talking about the crime that we were talking about earlier on.
Yes.
To what extent do you think this is because crimes aren't punished? And to what extent is it because people have kind of, they don't care about this country anymore? There's no patriotism and they're not bothered about their fellow citizens or the country.
There is a young lady at the back with a blue jacket and a slightly cerise shirt.
Hi, yes, thank you. And a question specifically to Yusuf, actually. Your 10 councils that you now have control of, how many will be applying to the central fund to have funding to investigate into grooming / rape gangs, however you learn they are termed?
Okay, very... on the nose there, and there's a young man in the middle row, right in the heart there. Yeah, a young man with smartly knotted tie.
Thank you. So my question for both of you guys, because you talked like net zero down a lot, and I talked about how it leads to expensive energy prices. But if you're interested in lower energy prices, isn't the main thing that you should be doing producing more green energy? Because A, all the oil that we produce is sold in international markets, and B, the reason that our electricity prices are so expensive relative to other countries is because it's priced in gas rather than renewables, which is the cheapest form of energy.
And can I ask you, am I right in thinking that you're a student at one of London's finest schools? at Harris Westminster.
Maybe.
Yes. For those of you who don't know, Harris Westminster is a state school that now gets more of its students into top universities than many of the most expensive private schools in the country, and its students are a brilliant example of what state education can achieve, even if you disagree with their views on net zero. Anyway, so the key things are crime, net zero, and grooming gangs. Jake.
I was looking up the debates that were held in the House of Commons on lowering the voting age to 18 from 21, and the then Labour minister said that he had been told of a cuneiform tablet that complained about the behaviour of the young and how they were much worse and less patriotic than they had been in the past. Now, as far as I'm aware, no such cuneiform tablet exists, but the point is a fair one. No, I don't believe the young are less patriotic than we were. I think they might be as silly as the Oxford Union was in the 1930s and say they wouldn't vote for King and Country, but wouldn't fight for King and Country, but if necessary, they would. And I've got lots of children, so I have some knowledge of the young, though I was never actually young myself. I always rather I rather disapproved of it. And so I think it's not so much about punishment, it's about being caught. And it's why you want the police out and about on the street. Now, many of us must be motorists. If you see a police car and you've had a momentary lapse and you're going at 71 miles an hour on the motorway, what do? You slow down to 69. You actually don't like to overtake a police car, even if it's going under the speed limit, because you think your speedometer may be wrong. If you're on my 1936 Bentley, the speedometer goes all over the place. It almost certainly is wrong. We all obey the law when the Rozzers are on duty. And that applies across society. And I think we just need to see the police on the streets. We've got more police than we've ever had before. We've got thousands of them, but nobody ever sees them. You should watch Carry On Policeman or Carry On Sergeant. And you see, they just went out from their station every day. And they walked along, and I mean, they weren't very good at it because they were in a Carry-On film. But the general principle of having the police there, where they could summon support with a whistle, so you had to have a policeman reasonably nearby to come, and that kept crime very low. But I don't think it's because we're naturally more criminal or our children aren't patriotic. I'm going to leave the question on grooming gangs in reform councils to Zia because it's directed at him. On net zero, no, I just don't accept that renewables are cheaper. They're not. The argument that they're cheaper assumes that they run all the time and you don't have to have the backup. We maximize the cost of gas because it's on standby. So when we had a period in the winter when there was no wind and it was a cold day, we are bringing on stream gas-powered stations that are operating for a few hours a year. So you've got all that capital cost in a gas-powered station that has to be returned when it is producing a small amount of electricity for a small period of time. So you start paying millions of pounds for your marginal demand for energy. If we were running our gas-powered stations all year round, as our flexible part of our energy system with nuclear as our base load, energy would be much cheaper and we should be fracking, because the argument that Ed Miliband comes up with, that producing our own resources has no effect on international price, is both entirely true and entirely false. It's entirely true because it will still be the international price. It's entirely false because pricing is at the margin. So if you produce in the European market, which is separate from the US market, an extra cubic foot of gas, and therefore supply exceeds demand by a cubic foot, the price falls. So if we added on the millions of cubic feet that we could get out of fracking, the European price would fall. And what we're currently doing by not fracking is bringing gas over from the United States, or indeed from the Middle East, which has to be turned into LNG, and then it has to be regasified, which is both expensive and uses a lot of energy, so lots of emissions. And this is before I get onto the absolute racket that is Drax, for which you are paying £6 billion, and it would be cheaper and emit less carbon dioxide, if you mind about this, if we use the coal that is within 10 miles of the Drax power station. It is all a complete racket and is making people cold and poor.
I suspect that you probably won't disagree much with what Jacob has said on energy, but if there is anything, please feel free. But on the grooming gang question, and also on the crime question, at the weekend you were talking about the need to restore a sense of patriotism, to remoralise young people. Yeah. I don't know if you wanted to touch on either of those.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with the question about the rape gangs. Look, we've been very clear within the first 30 days of if Nigel becomes the next Prime Minister and we have a reform majority, we will launch a national statutory inquiry where witnesses are compelled under criminal penalty should they fail to show up. We think that is ultimately the only way that we can have a no stones unturned inquiry that holds everybody to account, not just the probably thousands of monstrous perpetrators who still roam free, but also the many, probably hundreds, of people who were officials, social workers, potentially police officers, who catastrophically failed in their solemn duty to protect those young girls. In terms of how we will govern locally, look, we've been very clear about this. To the degree that we can, we will pull those levers of power with every ounce of might that we have. So we already have lawyers looking at what we can do locally to, look, we want to do as much good as quickly as possible, and you have my assurance as chairman of the party that we're going to do that, and hopefully we'll have something we can announce. But obviously, as I've frequently said, the levers of power at local government pale in comparison to those that Yvette Cooper wields, but we will do everything that we can. In terms of crime and, let's call it, civic duty, yeah, look, I think, you know, my inbox is log-jammed with young people, starting from age 9 all the way through up to, let's say, 24, 25 years old, who tell me that they have been taught in schools that they should despise their country's history, that they should be ashamed of it, that the British Empire was a scourge on humanity, and that, therefore, I actually slightly disagree with Jacob, that I think there are many Gen Zers these days who have actually gone on TikTok and announced that they would not fight for their country, particularly in response to potential conscription around a potential conflict with Russia around Ukraine. So I think this is a very serious problem. We've seen the character assassination of Sir Winston Churchill's legacy writ large. We've seen his statue having to be boarded up in order to not apparently provoke protesters. This is a source of great shame for this country, particularly during the week where we celebrated VE Day, which was incredibly moving. So I think the education system, and I'm not claiming this is something we can solve in our first 30 days, but it is something we will work incredibly hard. Nigel's already said on the record he's happy to go to war with the teaching unions if necessary. We have to instill in our young people a sense of great pride in their country. And while of course, there are some elements of the history of the United Kingdom that we should not be proud of, no country, in my view, has a history of which it should be more proud than Britain, has a history of giving more to the free world than the United Kingdom. We should be hugely proud of that. And if we fail to do that, we do live in a fiercely competitive world. There are countries out there growing faster than the UK, with economies larger than ours already, that are not programming their young people to hate their country and to hate their history. So I think we need a real change in that. There are not many politicians, by the way, that can change culture. I think Nigel is one of those politicians.
Thank you, Zia. And we will... Three more questions from the floor, and then I'll wrap up with some quick-fire questions from the chair. And yes, the lady in the slightly floral jacket.
I have a question for the panel. Labour, on the 19th of May, is going to take steps to sign a security pact with the EU. A lot of people feel this is just a backdoor, a backslide, to take us back into Europe. Mm. What do the panel think about this, and is this a betrayal?
Very good question. And young gentleman over there at the far end, with the sweater and the open neck shirt.
This is mainly directed towards Jacob, but to a lesser extent towards you, Michael. So for someone who is a member of the government for the past 14 years, you seem remarkably critical of it. When you look back on your tenure in the government, do you view it with a sense of accomplishment? And in the unlikely case, was the Conservatives ever to make a sort of a resurgence and come back into the government, do you actually think they'd be any more successful in, you know, in your own words, you know, the decline of a country that you've sort of presided under in the past 14 years?
Yeah. Very fair challenge. And gentlemen here.
Thank you. Going back to the comments about taking down unsuitable flags from town halls, can we also make sure that the Union flag and all the Cross of St George, or the Welsh Dragon or Scottish Saltire are flown from civic buildings? That may help patriotism a little.
Thank you. And sir?
Hello, good evening. So listening to Jacob this evening, and I was listening to Suella yesterday evening, actually, there still seems to be this belief that somehow the Conservatives can turn it around. So I'm wondering what it would take for them to realise they're riding the dead horse and essentially jump ship or change track. And coincidentally, I saw that Reform are currently polling 1% off of Labour in Tower Hamlets today off of the back of the polling. So would Reform winning in Tower Hamlets maybe be that?
Absolutely. So let me, as well as being chair, respond directly to two of the points. On the whole question about the Security Pact, we don't need a renegotiation with the European Union in order to cooperate in security terms with them. Everything that the European Union has been asking of us is a reprise of things that David Frost and others said no to during the previous Brexit negotiations. And I'm afraid the European Union are trying, in an Irish phrase, to get us to buy the same horse twice. And in particular, some of the rhetoric that's been used about the youth mobility scheme seems to me to be... how can I best put it? If the government were to accept it, it would be naive in the extreme. But I don't hold that much hope of the government being sufficiently clear-sighted to see the trap into which they are being lured. On the question of the things that went wrong over the last 14 years, I could spend a lot of time, I shan't now, running over the individual challenges and frustrations that we faced. Suffice it to say that there were some very, very good things that were achieved, but also there were some significant errors, compromises, and mistakes. And if you're looking for guilty men and women, I'm as guilty as anyone. Jacob.
Thank you. Well, I want to continue on that, because actually, one of the things of which we should be absolutely proudest is what Michael did at education. And very unusually in politics, we have the control experiment, because Zia was pointing out we see the failure of Scottish and Welsh education, which didn't follow Michael's reforms, and British English education. It is English for once. I'm not making that terrible Englishman's mistake of referring to the whole country as England. English education has gone up all the league tables thanks to this man. It is a fundamental achievement. The other thing we achieved was Brexit. And that happened because David Cameron, who may not be the most popular man in this room, delivered on his promise to have a referendum, and the British people, in their wisdom, voted to leave. And this ties in with the Labour betrayal in the first question. I think it is an attempt to betray. I think they want to get us back in. I wouldn't trust the Labour Party an inch on this. If we give away a single fish, you know that it is a betrayal, because fish doesn't really particularly go with submarines. It's nothing to do with the defence pact. It's just a cheat by the French, and we should watch out for it. It's one of the reasons I like the Indian deal, because every time we do a free trade deal with somebody else, it makes a betrayal of Brexit harder, because Labour would look particularly stupid if on the 19th of May they said, well, we're agreeing something with the EU, and therefore we've got to cancel the trade deal we've just done with the Indians, which if they do too much, they would have to do. So every trade deal I quite like from a Brexit perspective, but yes, watch out for a betrayal. I didn't mention in the answer that the failures, inevitably once you're out of government, you concentrate on the failures more than the successes. I think our biggest failure was not reversing the Blairite settlement of how we're governed. And that is it's the Human Rights Act, which should go and we should leave the European Convention on Human Rights. It's the NES. It's the net zero legislation 2008. We should repeal the Climate Change Act, and we should repeal the Equality Act as well, 2010. Now, all three of these we couldn't have repealed in 2010 to 15 because we were in coalition with the Lib Dems. After that, we were basically taken up with Brexit and then COVID, and then we were out. So there are reasons why we didn't do these things, but any new right-wing government, and I hope Reform will listen to this, because if they do win, I would wish them extremely well, needs to get the levers of power back. The reason the courts kept on overturning any Conservative decision was because of the Human Rights Act, the Climate Change Act, and the Equality Act. Those were the three bugbears of ministerial decision-making, and they must all go. Then, patriotism and flying flags on civic buildings. Well, I'm not an American, in case you hadn't noticed. And I don't want to salute the flag. I quite like pictures of the king being put up in civic buildings. But I liked it when we flew the flag on red letter days. And when you saw the flag flying, you would say, why is the flag flying today? And it would turn out to be, oh, I don't know, the Duke of Kent's birthday, or something wonderfully obscure and wonderfully British. And I think we've got rather too American in I hate it as a minister, this idea we all had to have flags behind us when we were photographed. I thought if a minister of the crown had to prove he was patriotic by having a flag coming out of his head, he couldn't be much of a minister of the crown. I thought it should just be obvious that ministers of the crown were patriotic. So I'm a bit old-fashioned, surprise you, in this particular area. And then, yeah, are the Conservatives dead? Well, I don't know, I'm the resurrection and the life. Not me personally, but look, the Tory party, in one form or another, has been going, how far do you want me to take this back? I'll play safe and I'll go for Charles I. I have on occasions made the argument that you can trace it back to King Alfred the Great. But the Tory party has been going for hundreds of years, and I think it will survive in some form or another. I think it may well have to cooperate with Reform, and we may have to cooperate on Reform's terms rather than ours. But in a first-past-the-post system, that may be in the best interests of the country.
I sense that the audience is very sympathetic to the points that you've laid out, Jacob. The current Member of Parliament for North East Somerset has got himself into a spot of bother. And it may well be that he has to stand down from the House of Commons. Hands up those people here who would want Jacob to put himself forward once again for North East Somerset. Hands up.
Well, thank you very much. Jacob. I'm touched, thank you.
If such an eventuality were to arise, might you?
Oh, look, I loved being in the House of Commons, and I think the thing is, there is so much to be done. This country is being so appallingly governed at the moment, and I'm champing at the bit to see us better governed. And what do we learn from Trump? We learn from Trump that you can use executive power to do what you promised. And if only we could have a government that would come in and do what it promised, that would be such an exciting thing to be a supporter of, a cheerleader for. So, yeah, I'd love to get back.
You know what I'm going to ask, dear. It's a by-election, not a general election. If we have a by-election in North East Somerset, surely Reform must stand aside for Jacob. As you yourself said, the House of Commons would be better off with him in it.
I wouldn't
it's just a one-off, it's not a precedent.
I
just
wouldn't
a one-off.
Expect you to.
Well, Jacob hasn't yet put himself forward to be the Reform candidate for that seat. So I would hate to get ahead of ourselves. Look, I think we're in a situation where I think the country is... we've said for about a year now we're on a time-limited mission. We think unless we have a Reform government and that Nigel's Prime Minister in 2029, I'll be candid, I don't think this is a country we'd want to raise our children in. I think it will be beyond saving. Just be
completely candid. That's why we work as hard as we do. And I think deep in their bones, many people in this country now feel that. There's obviously a number of questions there. I just want to address the point about flags.
Please.
Because, you know, the point about flags comes in the context where, and I appreciate V-Day was actually a delightful respite, actually, seeing all of so much patriotism in an incredible, moving way, the Red Arrows, the veterans, and the celebrations. But one could walk around London, the capital of this country, one of the greatest cities in the world, and most of the year, and see pretty much every conceivable flag conveying different nations, different sexual preferences, except the Union Jack and except the St. George's flag. And that's really what that point was, that it is about time that somebody stood up and said, no, this, certainly for the councils in which reform is controlled, this is England, this is the United Kingdom, this is that particular county, and there is something deeply powerful about that, and that's why it resonates with people so much. So, look, we are at a fork in the road in the history of this country. We have a seismic opportunity. And one of the things about reform events, if you've ever been to one of those, is that they're unbelievably positive, effervescent, optimistic events. They're certainly the only events with a pyrotechnics budget. Nigel's the only person in British politics who'd pull that off. And I think the reason for that is because we're simultaneously very clear-eyed about the challenges this country faces and that this is a ship careering towards a cliff edge. But we're also incredibly optimistic about where the country can get to. So that's the opportunity at hand. That's why we're so excited and honoured about the results that we've just had. It's why we're going to work our socks off in local government and demonstrate to British people that they are correct in trusting us with their vote.
Thank you, Zia. Thank you. Can I thank our guests who've been extraordinarily generous with their time and candid in their assessment of British politics today? Can we hear it for Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg? For Zia Yusuf. And for Lucy Dunn and James Heal of The Spectator. I also want to thank again our partner, Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. As I mentioned earlier, if you were lucky enough to win a place at our drinks reception, please do join us. Oh, gosh, sorry, that's Kemi. No, please do join us in the Spectator Gardens now at 22 Old Queen Street. Fear not, if you didn't win a place, we'll be running a competition again. And if you have any feedback on this evening you'd like me to read, then email me at editor@spectator.com. .co.uk, and we will do our very best to incorporate your thoughts to make sure that the future events that we bring you at The Spectator are the events that you, our subscribers and readers, want, because we are here for you. Thank you all so very much. Thank you.